This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the Shuttle to Mars podcast. Shuttle to Mars is a brilliant comedy slash life lesson podcast hosted by up-and-coming actor Frankie Mars. Follow Frankie as she explores her own dumb decisions to make you feel better about your own. Basically, her life is a giant mess. But she's here to spill the tea about being an actor in New York, filter through all the clowning around, and attempt to crack the code on how being an adult is meant to work. Everything from having a career in acting, to relationships, to the world's most embarrassing stories are all discussed on Shuttle to Mars. Find the Shuttle to Mars podcast on all major podcast directories, or by visiting frankiemars.com. That's FrankieMars.com. Or follow on Instagram at Frankie Mars. Right, let's start the show. Hello and welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, co-owner of the company Horns of Odin, and I'm joined, as always, by Nordic Studies Professor and now music sensation, Dr. Matthias Nordvig.
Hi, and thanks for the wonderful intro.
You're a rock star now. So our guest today is musician Andrew Solf. Did I pronounce that right?
Yeah, as far as I know.
it's like my last name, Farrand. Like, I just pronounce it how I think it's meant to be said. No one's ever really told me. I just figure it out as I go along.
What? I live in America, and so proper pronunciation of last names is not a very high on the docket list thing for Americans.
Oh, no, that's true. I've, as a Scandinavian, I've definitely realized that my name gets butchered in all kinds of ways here.
As a Brit, I think it's proper pronunciation of a lot of words Americans struggle with. I mean, for me, niche is one of the real bugbears that kind of wind me up when I hear.
Oh, I hate niche. I hate that.
Yeah, for me, it's a French word. Please just try and say it French, not just niche.
That's so funny because, you know, I mean, most of those loan words, right? Brits and Danes will pronounce them similarly. We would say, I mean, the word exists in Danish too. We have niche, right? That's just what we say. And yeah, I know it's really hilarious that it gets butchered this way in America. But I try to fit in over here, so I must admit that I purposefully butcher words like niche.
Do you say Craig as well?
Absolutely.
Oh, instead of Craig?
I say Craig.
Craig.
That's not a bad Yorkshire accent.
I love your accent. I wish I had that. I've described, because I'm originally from Montana, and I've described the accent there as kind of like bass line without any inflection up or down. It's kind of the driest accent.
I think you could say that about Yorkshire accent as well, to be honest.
Except for the fact that I hear like the rounding out of a lot of words and the dropping of some syllables.
Yeah, that's just being lazy and kind of just missing whole letters out.
Like tattooing.
Yeah, and like I'm from, I live in a town called Huddersfield, but people from here do not pronounce the H. It's just Huddersfield. Mm-hmm. And that you just miss the H off completely.
We have a similar things happening in Danish. I mean, there's so many consonants that we just skip.
Yeah, G is dropped a lot in Montana in ing stuff. So instead of, you know, gunning, it's gunning. All tons of words like that. Mm.
Yeah, I find accents absolutely fascinating, especially in England, because I mean, I can travel 50 miles or less and the accent will completely change. You know, you have like Scouse from kind of the Liverpool area when we had Lloyd on, and he has this thick Scouse accent, and he's maybe an hour and a half drive from me, and then you go an hour and a half north, you go to like Newcastle area and you get this thick Geordie accent. And it's, and then down again, if you go an hour and a half south, you get like a Brummie, kind of that Peaky Blinders accent. And it's, even though we're all quite close geographically, you know, it's a couple of hours drive, but the accents are
Liverpool different. And stuff. One of my best friends lives in Merseyside, not too far from Liverpool, and that's an accent too.
I mean, for me, I pick up, I hear it and I understand what people are saying, but I imagine to other people, they really struggle.
Daniel, I wanted to ask you, how much is BBC English influencing your accents these days? Like, is that a thing?
Oh, probably not at all. I mean, I don't watch the news.
Okay, fair enough.
I think most people nowadays probably don't get as, I would say, I imagine like things like Netflix and American TV shows will influence more than anything, because I think the news cycle has become so unwatched almost. Like most people, I guess, don't get up in the morning, sit down, have a cup of tea and put the news on. Almost everything's on their phone, either, or they, Alexa, what's the news today? Or, you know, it's...
Well, everyone's watching American news because you can't get crazier than what's happening now. It seems like the first time in history that literally everyone, especially across Europe, is very invested in American news.
I think, you know, it's always been there. Like, for instance, a country like Denmark, any Scandinavian country, really, there is so much about America in our news for different reasons. Like, on the one hand, because we think America is very similar to us. And on the other hand, also because it's like this big mystical place at the edge of the world.
That's interesting. a mystic. I've never heard America described as mystical.
It is to an extent. Like it is a place where we put different, like our imagination goes to in different ways. Like, and this is of course, you know, for various, you know, reasons. Like the whole cowboy myth is part of that, right? You know, so many Scandinavians have you know, distant relatives that at some point, you know, migrated. I mean, like I can name like four or five people in my family alone who migrated. So it's for about 150 years at least, North America has been that place of some kind of mystery, right? And I think that has sort of precipitated into our news cycle. So, you know, we love reporting on America in Scandinavia, and we also very much like the twist of like, these guys are crazy.
Like, that's part of it. Yeah, I'm second generation American Danish, and so I guess I think of Denmark as the mystical homeland. Yeah,
of course, yes, yeah. But no, it's Daniel, I just wanted to get back to the thing about language, because it's really interesting. The reason I asked about like BBC is that the Danish version of the BBC, we have our own like national broadcast, right? And that Danish language that is being spoken there has pretty much at this point completely obliterated any dialects and accents in the Danish countryside. Yeah, so you don't go, well, you can still go to pockets here and there and find sort of like a curious way of speaking Danish, but it's almost gone, unfortunately. And you know, it's interesting because we know of Norwegian dialects, right? And Norwegians can also typically understand it and understand each other, right? The only Scandinavians they don't understand are the Danes, because we're too slurry in that speech.
That's why I've chosen to learn Norwegian, actually, even though I'm Danish. I didn't have very many potatoes around me to put in my mouth, so.
That's fair. I mean, when people ask me, as a former Danish teacher, I don't teach Danish language anymore, but as a former Danish teacher, when people ask me, what Scandinavian language should I learn? I always say Norwegian. it's easier.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, accents are certainly alive in the UK. They don't seem to be going anywhere at all. Like, say, you can go even 20 minutes from here south to Sheffield, Barnsley kind of area, and now that is an accent. That's kind of like mine, but even more, even like, imagine my accent, but even just even stronger and thicker and even less letters missing.
Like, that's awesome.
It's It's definitely a fun one.
Yeah, and then you've got Scotland with like Cork and Edinburgh.
There's some places up there that even I have to like second listen to. I'm like, what is that? What did you just say? So, Andrew, before the show, you were telling us about your surname and how we have a little thing in common.
Yeah. So, between mixing some DNA stuff like with 23andMe, and then I took some of that data to another company that disseminates it a little bit deeper, and then using that with what I do have of historical family documents, I was able to trace my father's side of the family to York or Jorvik, so Yorkshire, your neck of the woods. And so they were able to find the original the first permutation of the last name, Self, meaning sea wolf, how they found it in the Doomsday Book. And so presumably we think that it might be the some of the Norwegians that came over and settled there. And then on my mother's side of the family, they're all from Copenhagen.
Got a little bit of mix in there. So, Matthias, is that a kind of name you've heard from the Scandinavian world? Is Sof a, you know, like a Norwegian name?
So this is, it sounds like a very, it sounds like a very special name. Obviously, if you find it in the Doomsday Book and it's derived from Scandinavian, it's probably a name that was used in some capacity, a broader capacity.
Yeah, it's definitely anglicized for sure, especially the sea part.
So when you say, you know, it means sea wolf, is that an Anglo-Saxon meaning for it?
Yeah, I think when they're saying sea wolf, they're probably alluding to the fact that they're Vikings, I would imagine.
Yeah. And, you know, it sounds like a really interesting name because sea wolf, that's a Haiti, maybe even Kenning to an extent, right? So a circumlocution of the word warrior, right? Sea warrior is what we're dealing with here. So it's a very Viking name. It's pretty badass, actually.
Yeah, which is, I had to stick with that for my musical name. So,
yeah, I'm pretty jealous. I think my surname comes from France, and it means like the old gray or something like that.
That's kind of cool.
It's not too much. It's not a sea wolf, though.
Well,
is it?
Yeah, a gray took down Liam Neeson. So,
oh well, yeah, it did. Well, I mean, he's getting old a bit now.
Yeah.
But I mean, mine, Nordvig, just means North Bay. I mean, the cool thing about it, I guess, is that it includes the word North and also Vik, which is the first part of Viking. But, I mean, it just means, you know, that family that lived over there. In the...
You just existed. Nobody really took note.
Yeah, those guys over there.
So, Andrew, as you mentioned, that is your musical name, and I'm sure people will be wondering why I said Matthias is now a music sensation at the top of the show. So let's speak about that. I want to know how it all started, how you two collaborated.
Yeah, the musical project itself started right when the pandemic hit. By trade, I'm a film and TV editor here in Hollywood, and although I had gotten into music during college, I had kind of moved away from that and just kind of focused myself in other things and learning and film and TV. And once that was kind of taken away from me, because you know pretty much everybody in this industry right now is just kind of at home twiddling their thumbs. I needed some kind of creative outlet, and so I took my Trump tax check and bought a MIDI keyboard and some other stuff. And while I was editing, because I do a lot of editing at home while I do that, and if I'm not working on sound stuff, I've been listening to a lot of lo-fi music, really good music just to kind of like focus in and gives you kind of a nice beat. Just to, it's not too fast, not too slow, just kind of this nice beat that I can work at.
Just to jump in quickly, I know you said, I saw you describe it as kind of like Viking lo-fi. What is lo-fi for somebody who's, I'm not very musically sound, as we've said on the show many times.
Yeah, so lo-fi is, it's named really after low fidelity, and it kind of describes one of the aspects of the genre, which is kind of crackly, lower quality recordings of instruments, mainly like pianos and saxes and drums. And so everything kind of sounds a little bit more muted, kind of old vinyl. A lot of the times you'll hear kind of vinyl crackle put in the background of some of these songs. And so as I was listening to it, I listened to a lot of Viking and pagan folk stuff. And it just kind of jumped in my head, what would it sound like if I added some of those things? You know, if the topic of some of this stuff was, you know, less Asian girls studying in their dorm rooms and more Vikings, what would that kind of sound like? And so I had played around a little bit to try to get that sound. And once I had a few songs, I was like, you know, actually, I really like this music. So I kind of decided to move forward with it. Matthias, I had been following him on YouTube. We had met at Midgardsblot, and so I had, once I decided on making an EP, I was like, okay, let's do 6 songs. I had written out kind of a wish list of people that I would love to collaborate. I figured try to get as many people in the kind of, you know, in the Viking community involved, just to not only give it legitimacy, but honestly, in hindsight, my favorite songs are the ones that I've collaborated with people on. And so, yeah, I reached out to him, and he was awesome, and jumped on the song.
Yeah, you do. You don't just kind of advise any Matthias, don't you? Do a little bit of singing on there as well.
Yeah, no, it's yeah. Andrew was like, would you mind reading this? What was it? Is it a full or?
I think it was a stanza and like at the end of the first stanza before it. Yeah, from I think Völuspá, right?
Yeah, Völuspá stanzas. What is 2021 or something?
I think
something
so. Yeah. There. It's speaking about Urdsvell, and so that particular song, Uthrbrunner, is about you know, the Norns weaving the fates of mankind. And so when I came up with the idea of that song, the idea had popped into my head of what would it, if these Norns were just kind of like sitting down on their little desk at the base of Yggdrasil, and they were, you know, they wanted to choose some music on Spotify, what would their song be? What would it sound like if they had like the perfect study music to start writing people's fates? And that's kind of how that song began.
That's quite interesting. I wonder, I never really thought of it like that, them kind of listening to music whilst working. And I wonder, depending on the type of music they were listening to, what people's fate would be, you know, like if right. A little bit of thrash metal comes on, there's going to be some going on. And if it's a bit of Coldplay or something quite mellow, it's very sort of sad.
Yeah,
dramatic.
Sitting there listening to Cannibal Corpse, and I'm like, I am weaving this guy a car crash.
It explains Ragnar very well.
It does, yeah. Doesn't it?
Oh, I get it. Okay, they were listening to Cannibal Corpse.
Yeah. But no, actually, the stanza that you chose for this, or the passage in general, is one of the more beautiful parts of the poem Völuspá. It talks about the tree of world tree Yggdrasil, the well at its foot, and it's always come off as sort of like a paradisical image for me. So yeah, when Andrew said, like, would you mind reading this for me? I was like, yeah, hell yeah.
Is that the first time you've been on a song?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. This might actually be my debut as a quote unquote singer.
There we go. So, Andrew, does the EP follow a set path? Tell us a little bit about it, what your plans are. I know you've put a lot of thought into it.
Yeah. So, one of the first ideas that had kind of popped in my head of like the project overall, because I guess I approached this whole creative project from a kind of a storytelling idea, and I guess kind of like just like how you would kind of produce a movie, and even the songs, when I'm creating them, I approach it very much like how I'm editing things, putting a story together, taking a whole bunch of stuff and making a story out of it. And so one of the first ideas that popped in my head was, okay, to kind of give a beginning and end of, I guess, the musical project, I'd like to do 9 albums over my career. And so potentially that gives me till I die. and name each one of them after the realms. But as an EP, to kind of get things started, it made sense to name it Gnunga Gap after where everything kind of started and bloomed from. And then it made even more sense because this whole creative project was something positive that had kind of come out of the darkness of what I'm experiencing, where I'm at. I live in downtown Los Angeles. And so during this time, I've been surrounded by the protests that have been going on. Every night has been fireworks and explosions that I hear until like 3 a.m. Luckily, it's calmed down a little bit right now, but definitely for a few months there, it was loud, lots of helicopters and stuff like that. And then obviously, you know, politically, all the turmoil and then the pandemic. And so there's just so much kind of stress and darkness that I was going through. It was nice to kind of, you know, create something positive out of that and something that just kind of made me smile. And so, yeah, thematically, it really fit. It happened really organically. And so there's the 6 songs, and the loose story really is kind of Gnunga Gap as it is, and then all of the things that are springing forth from it. You know, we had the ice that had dropped into it and eventually made Ymir, and then you had all from that, all the sons and daughters, and then from the death of some of these people, you had the world. And so it's interesting to see that how out of that darkness, some really positive and interesting things were born from it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I imagine it was a pretty terrifying time when the protests were going on. I heard quite a few crazy things.
Yeah, they're not. The protests aren't really over.
No, it's pretty much been solid every night, and it kind of happens at a different location every night somewhere in LA. But definitely downtown is kind of the staple for it, just because obviously we have City Hall here and a lot of the police headquarters and stuff like that are, you know, right across the street. And so one of the cool things out of this was an idea that Matthias had given me to take some of the proceeds from the song that he had worked on and donate them to the Bail Project, which helps out people who are incarcerated. And America kind of has this weird thing where we just there's a lot of people, especially people of color, that get incarcerated for no good reason, and they're kind of held ransom and they have to give money. And if you think about that idea objectively, it's super strange that you just have to put up tons of money to get out. And really, it should be a question of are you safe to go out or not? Money shouldn't really be involved. And so a cool organization like that is helping people with that. And hopefully we see some kind of reform. I think we'll see some reform, hopefully, after the election, in going in that direction.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, as a Brit, that seems completely insane. We don't have anything like that. Like you say, it's whether you're safe to be out or not. And that's kind of how it works. The way you guys have it, it just seems you know, you're punishing poor people who can't raise the money. And I think I remember hearing a crazy statistic that it was like in the high 90% of people who took a sort of guilty plea because they knew they couldn't raise the money to get bail, and rather than sit in jail for the next possibly, it could be years before they go to trial. So they said they was guilty to something they probably didn't even do. They just knew that taking the guilty plea was better than the other thing.
No, the problem comes down to the 13th Amendment, which abolished, actual slavery, but then introduced prison slavery instead. Because that's the only way that you can enslave people in America these days, through prison systems. And that has then, snowballed into this prison industrial complex that basically makes sure that to funnel as many people in society into it, and make sure to keep them in there. And this, of course, has a huge effect on the African American communities, where poverty levels are much higher and, different kinds of drugs are rampant, and they're being targeted for that.
Yeah. And then you've got private prisons too, which is another just wacky idea. But luckily, California being kind of the one of the more progressive places, they've not too long ago, they outlawed private prisons here. So.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. I'm so happy to hear that, because, even in Denmark, they've been talking about privatizing prison systems, and I've been like, that's bullshit, guys.
It's funny because, I went to school in Canada for high school and college, and there was always, especially it would be kind of like the more conservative right wing groups were always talking about privatizing the Crown Corps and stuff like that. And so I imagine that's something that exists in most of the other socialist countries. But they should take a look at America and see how well that works.
Yeah. Well, usually it comes from, some of our politicians going to different kinds of quote unquote conventions. I'd call them ideological training camps or something like that, in the American South. That's a real thing, guys. Just think about that.
I did not know that existed.
Yep. We like several conservative politicians in Denmark have at some point been at some kind of training camp with conservative groups outside of the country. This is really interesting because I think I remember something about scandals with this back in the Cold War era, where communists got trained to be communists in certain countries. I don't know. Guys, I just don't know. Maybe that's a problem.
Before we get too political, let's jump back to music. But on that point, though, there is an absolutely brilliant documentary on Netflix called The 13th, which explains everything we've just spoke about in depth. So it's definitely worth a watch, and it really clears up some of the horrible things that happen in the prison system in America. So back to the music and the good things coming out of this. So like I say, the EP is called Gnungaga, mm-hmm. and then you've got six songs within that. Mateus obviously features on one of them. So, like you said, they all kind of surround different things that come from the creation of the world.
Yeah.
And I guess it's a good time for anybody that's listening that, I guess we get people listening to this that are all different levels of their Norse mythology path. Some know a lot, some might just be starting out and know absolutely nothing. So I guess if we jump over to Mateus, who can just tell us a little bit about the creation of the world, where we find it, what happens, some of the crazy things that go on, even down to like what the Gnunga Gap is. I mean, I guess to anybody that's never heard it, it sounds like an absolutely batshit crazy word.
Yeah. So we have actually a couple of versions of the creation myth. We have Snorri Sturluson's prose version in the Edda that he wrote in 1220 approximately in Iceland. And then we have the poem Völuspá, that we talked about just before, where this dance that I'm reading on the song comes from. That also gives us some details on the creation of the world. And actually, Snorri uses Völuspá as his source, and also references to other Eddic poems. Völuspá, just for those who are not familiar, Völuspá is a so-called Eddic poem. It's composed in the meter that is called Fornyðislag, which means the meter of ancient sayings or something like that, or ancient words. And it's probably the oldest poem that we have available, besides a couple of snippets of skaldic poems here and there. So this is hotly debated, but I think most scholars nowadays would agree that it's from the the end of the pagan era in Scandinavia. So so around the late 900s, early 1000s. And we know this also because one stanza in the poem is actually paraphrased or halfway quoted by a skaldic poet in the early 1000s. So we can roughly place it in that period right around when Scandinavians sort of officially convert to Christianity. The poem itself is really interesting because it's definitely a syncretic poem where we have a mix of pagan and Christian imagery in it. And so this means that it's probably a pagan, a non-Christian Scandinavian with knowledge about Christianity who composed this poem. It gives us a really interesting little story about the creation of the world. It goes, Arvas aldar, that ímir bygdi, var að sandar nisæja með svalar unnir. Jörfans eifan í óttim minn, gap var kynunga í grassvergi. Aður búsín ég bjóðum yttu þeir ef mýðgað meran skópu. Sólskinn sunnan að sala steina, þá var grungróin grænum löki. So basically this means, in the beginning of time there was nothing except for Ymir, this primordial giant who lived there, and there was no sand, no sea, no cool waves. The earth did not exist, nor did the heavens. The void was Ginnunga. That's where Ginnungagap comes from. This sentence, the void was Ginnunga, and there was no grass. That's how the world is described in this earliest version of the creation myth that we have.
So it's just a giant floating around in nothingness.
Well, that's kind of how Snorri Sturluson envisioned it. Whether or not the guy who composed this, or woman, it's probably actually, it could be a woman, because a völva is a female authority on religion in pre-Christian Scandinavia. So this could be a woman. But this is how Snorri Sturluson interprets it. The sentence that Ymir bygdi, where Ymir lived, gives us very little information actually. What are we talking about here? And then we have this gapas ginunga, which means the void was ginunga. And then we have dig into comparative mythology. We know, for instance, from Finnish mythology that they have a similar idea of a void, primordial sea, and then this female earth, a female figure that's swimming around in it. And this is a very common, cross-Eurasian creation myth, and we also find it in North America.
I guess it's kind of like a baby inside the, still inside the stomach. The womb's the right word, not stomach. You can tell I don't have kids.
that is exactly. I would definitely say that is part of, you know, the imagery that you get in the Finnish creation myth in Kalevala. So yeah, there's something going on there. And she also, I forget her name, unfortunately, but she also gives birth at one point to Väinämöinen, who then creates the world. But yeah, so the next stanza tells us how the sons of Bor, Björðum Yppu, which seems to mean something like raised the ground. And then they created Midgard. And then the sun shone on the rocks of the earth, Salastena, that actually means the stones of the hall, but probably referring to some kind of like, you know, the hall of the vault of the heavens and all that stuff. And then green grass and plants grow from the ground. It's the last part of that stanza. So something's going on here that actually, again, reflects a little bit of what happens in the Finnish creation mythology myth, where Väinämöinen, he goes around and he starts like sowing. He sows all kinds of trees and plants that are, you know, indigenous to Finland. It's a really beautiful myth, actually. And these guys here, the sons of Bor, they raise the ground. Maybe they plow. Maybe they bring the earth out of the primordial sea. And then they create Midgardr. And again, by inference from Snorri Sturluson, we may assume that Midgardr is created possibly by killing Ymir. But this is all Snorri, though. Snorri, he gives us this very interesting and elaborate, and I would say in many ways also very Icelandic version of the creation myth, where it starts with a cold realm in the north and a heated realm in the south, Niflheimr and Muspelheimr. And he then tells us that the coldness and the hotness they converge in the middle, and the area becomes temperate, and that's Ginnungagap. So that's where the word appears.
That's the version I've always heard, is, you know,
exactly
the fire and the ice meeting, and
yes. And I'm giving you both versions so that we all just understand the complexity of this tradition. So Ginnungagap, as Snorri Sturluson calls it, he picks it up from Völuspá, where it says Gap vas Ginnunga. And then he creates Ginnungagap from that. And this is where he then tells us that Ymir is created from the conversions of these rivers that flow from Niflheimr. He says there's, I think it's 11, and then the fire in Muspelheimr sends sparks, and this creates vapor that then rises. And there are some curious things. Actually, part of my dissertation was written about this particular myth, because it's a volcanic image. There's some curious aspects of this story that when you start looking into the words and the way that the natural image here behaves, it's not fire and ice. It's lava, guys. This is lava. Snorri Sturluson has been looking at lava and goes, this is how the world was created. And that's really impressive, if you ask me, because then we have a very early version of like a natural or sort of like a theory of how the world was created from natural processes, which actually is not that far out when it comes to medieval thinkers. This is something that, you know, since Plato, that they have been discussing, like, how was the world created? And Snorri Sturluson is borrowing a little bit from Platonic philosophy in terms of like this hot-cold convergence. Anyway, what we get is this image of like a stream of lava that comes from some kind of like, you know, maybe subglacial source that then flows out and gets a crust. And that's Ymir. We have Búri who comes out of this too, as this two generations removed ancestor of Odin, right? After him comes Bor, and then comes the three sons, Odin, Vili, and Ve, who Snorri says is the sons of Bor, or are the sons of Bor, right? So again, he picks up that little information from Völuspá. The sons of Bor were the ones who raised the ground, right? He picks that up and says, oh, that's Odin and his two brothers, Odin, Vili, and Ve, and they then kill Ymir because Ymir is evil, and all the giants or the Jötnar that come from Ymir, they cause, you know, evil or chaos.
So he's Ymir kind of asexual, just kind of pops these giants out of, like,
well, some of them come from his armpit and stuff. So.
That was something I heard, was like these giants come from his armpit, which is,
yeah, that's he's a hermaphrodite of sorts, right? The interesting thing about this is that there seems to be some so the implication of what I'm saying right now is that Snorri is making all this stuff up, and he definitely isn't. Like, we already see how he's using aspects of Völuspá. But aside from that, he's also using aspects of other myths that he's aware of that are only recorded with him, and then maybe also with Tacitus. Tacitus is a Roman historian who writes in the first century, the late part of the first century AD. He writes that these Germanic peoples that he's describing of their north of the Rhine, they believe that they descend from this being called Twisto, which might actually mean something like twin or, you know, split sexuality. So this first primordial being, which is also a chthonic being, so associated with the ground, right, creates these generations that the Germanic peoples and their tribes then come from, according to Tacitus, right? That sounds a little like this story of this chthonic being called Ymir, whose body becomes the ground, and whom the world is created from too. So there might actually be another, like Snorri Sturluson might actually be mixing several traditions when he is giving us these descriptions. See, the thing is that, you know, especially as modern scholars, we want to find all the logical aspects of all of this, like where do the puzzles fit? And that's not how the world works.
Especially with like pre-science peoples.
Exactly, especially with pre-science peoples. So like for about two centuries almost, scholars of Old Norse mythology have been discussing like what is the original version and how did that look, you know, and all of this stuff. And the answer is that we probably have several original versions mixed in together in Snorri Sturluson's attempt to make sense of them in what is also, you know, a little bit of a Greek philosophical tradition, a little bit of Christian philosophical tradition.
It sounds kind of like Snorri could have been the L. Ron Hubbard of the Viking Age.
You know, in scholarship, we are very skeptical about Snorri. We're always criticizing this poor guy. But to be honest, I mean, he deserves a lot of credit. He was sitting there in Iceland with the faculties that he had available to him and trying to make sense of all of this nonsense. And yeah, in some cases, he deliberately interprets things in context of Christianity and in context of what is considered appropriate philosophy and science to him, which is like this mix of like Christian theology and certain Greek philosophers. And yeah, he does mess with the material. But I mean, he made an appropriate attempt at, like, you know, giving the rest of us some kind of access to Nordic mythology. So I think he deserves credit for that.
Yeah, imagine not having it at all.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, we end up with a scenario where the sons of Bor, which according to Snorri are Odin, Vili, and Ve, they kill Ymir, and then they take his body and put it in, well, his own blood, right? Because Snorri tells us that Ginnungagap gets filled with Ymir's blood as they stab him, right? That drowns out all the evil giants, and then they put Ymir's body in the middle, and then they put his head, curiously, his skull on top of all of that to create a nice little circle here. That becomes the vault of the sky. His brain becomes the dark clouds, and then the hair on his body becomes the trees. His teeth become rocks, and their bones become mountains. And finally, they also create Midgather as this rampart from his eyebrows. So there's like this protective rampart around Midgather, and that's where we as humans live. And then outside somewhere, we have the surviving giants, because there is one giant who managed to escape the flood. And the flood as the deluge is the flood that he's talking about. It's Noah's Ark scenario.
Yeah,
because this guy, Bergelmir, he managed to save himself and his family in a little ark. That's what Snorri Sturluson says straight up. So that's where the Christian stuff comes in, right? That's like a Christian imagery, right? And that's why there are still giants out there and evil and all that stuff.
Yeah, I found it incredibly interesting. And you guys had kind of touched on it, I think, with Kati's interview about how our idea of the cosmology is probably more akin to places on Earth rather than the tree holding up these globes in space kind of a thing. And we kind of see some attempt to actually back in the 15th century to make sense of that, where they were trying to localize Ginnungagap. And they had kind of pinpointed it to, I think, like Baffin Bay area. So between Greenland and Baffin Island and Nunavut. So that kind of like that swirling water there in Ginnungagap. And then, presumably the rest of the world kind of goes out from there. And that makes a lot more sense, especially when you have people who haven't, they haven't gone in and mapped out the entire world yet. And so a lot of it is mystery. And so if you think from their perspective, it makes a lot of sense that areas beyond Scandinavia would have been considered different worlds.
Absolutely. That's interesting that you mentioned that. This actually begins already with the Adam of Bremen in the late thousands. So from 1070 is when he's writing, or around that time is when he's writing his history of the archbishops of Hamburg, Bremen, and also gives descriptions of Scandinavia. Because Scandinavia at the time sort of is a resort of the Hamburg archbishopric, and he locates Ginnungagap somewhere around the Greenlandic Sea, in his descriptions of the geography of the north too, although he calls it Ginnungagap, so he's got some kind of like Germanized version of it. But yeah, no, that's a tradition that keeps going and becomes very important in the 1600s, 1700s with various thinkers in Scandinavia. And this has also something to do with the Danish-Swedish rivalries, because they're basically, these guys are like scouring the Icelandic material in particular to find examples of how awesome the Danes or the Swedes respectively were back in the Viking Age, so that they could be awesome again and, get like all these wonderful, crazy statements like the Danes are basically just expelled criminals from Sweden and the Swedes were the original inhabitants of the Garden of Eden, and you know, all of these things.
So yeah, I mean, to play back to kind of like the nine realms idea, you don't have to Google like the Norse nine realms, and you get these images of these kind of worlds floating on different planes. You know, Asgard always kind of like at the top, and Hell, like Helheim at the bottom. And I guess that is kind of, I would assume that's more of a modern idea. You know, as we learn more, we learn about planets and that kind of thing. This idea of these realms being actual other worlds is, you know, that kind of, that's where it comes from, rather than them all being on one plane and all being part of, you know, part of Earth.
Yeah, stars would not have been thought of as, you know, the celestial bodies that they are. And so presumably existence really was just this kind of, you know, either globe or plane, and that's it.
Yeah. And we also, you know, the same with like the sun and the moon, they're considered like these agents in Norse mythology. It's you know, gods or humans or whatever you want to call them, some kind of like being that carries the sun and the moon on the sky. There are actually two versions of the story, right? What do we otherwise see? We see like the story about Thjazi, right? This eagle that attacks the gods. The gods then take his eyes and throw them into the sky so that they become stars. So that gives you a sense of like, the stars are these fixed little, I don't know, LED lights or something. So yeah, no, they didn't have those concepts. It's very typical for pre-scientific people to think about their world as our plane, where we exist, somewhere down below where the dead exist, and then sometimes a realm in the sky where gods, spirits exist of some kind, but gods and spirits exist on all three levels, though. They're not just relegated to up there. We do get in Snorri's description of the heavens and all that stuff, he does add a couple of levels to it. He talks about, what is it called? Vidblauin or Vidlang or something like that. As this like upper level that exists up there, where, you know, Odin presumably has Gimli and that stuff, and that is all taken from, you know, his standard medieval theology that he has learned a little bit about in some capacity.
So when we say that there's nine realms, are they kind of like definitively written down as nine realms? This is what they are in concrete, or because I guess, you know, you only have to kind of check online these different pictures that people have made of the nine realms, and you can find sort of disparities between the two. One will include something that the other one doesn't. Some will have like hell on its own and a Helheim. Some will have. So it seems like there's even some confusion amongst those.
You know, I really loved the imagery that the game God of War had kind of given, where, you know, they would just kind of get on the bridge and connect to these different lands that were just really kind of almost like countries, just kind of insular parts of land. That was really interesting how they visually represented that.
Yeah. The thing about the nine realms in a historical context is that our modern ideas of these nine realms come from a confluence of two things in Snorri Sturluson's description of the cosmology. The nine realms in the underworld, and then these mentions of different realms in other contexts. And it's very, it's chapter 34 of Gylfaginning in his Edda. He goes, then Allfather sent the gods to get the children, that's Loki's children, and bring them to him. And when they came to him, he threw the serpent, that's the giant world serpent that Thor is going to catch at some point, into the deep sea, which lies around all lands. And this serpent grew so that it lies in the midst of the ocean, encircling all lands, and bites on its own tail. Hel, which is, you know, the daughter of Loki, he threw into Niflheim and gave her authority over nine worlds. That's where you get the nine worlds from. They are levels of hell. And this is something that, again, he picks up from Christian theology. You know, medieval Christian theology, as I mentioned before, Dante, he's our best example. He's a little later than Snorri, but based in the same tradition of like thinking about the underworld as this tiered realm where, you know, depending on the type of sin, you end up in a certain place, right? And I think actually heathens, just for those of you who are listening, you end up in level five. So, and this is again a very old tradition. It's actually pre-Christian. This idea of like these different levels of underworlds and upper realms and all that stuff comes from Hellenic philosophy in Greece. And it has to do with moral philosophy to the ancient Greeks. And then it, you know, gets picked up by Christianity and gets turned around and ends up as nine realms in Snorri Sturluson's version of the cosmos. But if we start looking into these different realms, some of them are more valid than others. Some of them seem to just be named for the same thing, and so on and so forth. So it always takes a little bit of a leap of faith to start organizing different realms in that way from the Nordic mythology. I would say that if we go back to like 9th century Scandinavia and you asked these people who lived there, what does the world look like? They'd probably say, well, there's the dead there right over there in that mound, and then there's some kind of demon that lives over there in that forest or up there in that mountain, throws rocks at us once in a while. I don't know if any of you have ever experienced a rock slide. Actually, I was just up in Wyoming and just a small one what are they called, the Snowy Range, the peaks up there, and like I was hiking and along this pretty steep rock side, and then all of a sudden it just goes crack, boom, 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 and a couple of giant boulders just fall down. Right, if you don't have any scientific way of placing that in your world, I'm pretty sure that you would probably relegate that to the realm of demons. Like that demon just tried to throw a rock at me. Let's get out of here, right? That's how these guys would be thinking. And yeah, they might, you know, say, oh, so yeah, sometimes the demons come out of some place called Niederwettlir or something like that, right? To mess with us. But, you know, locating those realms, you know, in a very systematized way, I don't think would have happened for them. That there would be that, you know, below ground, that's where we get like all kinds of, you know, unpleasant, you know, figures of our imagination. You know, over there in the dark woods, there are unpleasant figures of our imagination, sometimes at least.
Yeah, I
think they're also pretty cool.
You know? I think it does well to remember that, you know, these are very localized people. Most of them won't travel within a couple of miles of their house, probably in their entire life, I guess. It's more, and even the ones that do travel well may board a ship and come to England. You know, it's not kind of like how we live in our world now, where, you know, you can speak, you know, we're speaking to Andrew all the way in, you know, Los Angeles. Like, that's kind of, we live in a completely different time where we know things and we're a much more globalized community. Whereas, you know, these people are very, very localized. So if they live near, I guess, near a volcano that erupts or bubbles, then they're going to have like a demon for that. But if you live near an area that's prominent to rock slides, then you have like a demon for that. So I guess these worlds will almost depend on where they are kind of geographically as much as anything.
Absolutely. Think about this. If you start reading Scandinavian folklore, like from Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, you get different types of monsters. In Denmark, which is low-lying country, as I've said so many times before, the Danish landscape consists of sludge that has been like washed out from the Norwegian mountains. Just like our language sounds like Norwegian slush too. and it's a low-lying country that is prone to a lot of flooding. And we have a lot of folk tales about trolls in, you know, lakes, trolls that cause flooding, you know, demon horses from hell that take, you know, drunk people home with them, or, you know, at least say they will, and then they drown them instead, that kind of stuff. We have from Sweden that also has a lot of bodies of water, and some of them can be problematic. We also have the stories about that also exists in Denmark, but the story of Nicken, right? This water man. In Sweden, we get a lot of stories about scary apparitions in the woods. Skogsuro, for instance, is a great example of that. This figure that shows up with a giant mouth and then stands in the door of this poor guy's house. He's out in the woods where he's burning coal, I think it is, which is something you would do out there, outside of the inhabited realm otherwise, right? And the Skogsrå comes from the darkness of the woods in the middle of the night, and then has like this giant mouth that goes from like the top and the bottom of his doorway, and then he's shouting, "What's your name?" Because you know, so there's all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, then you go back to Denmark and you can find those guys who sit out there and burn coal or watch the sheep at night and all that stuff, and they have like weird romantic experiences with swamp ladies. That
sounds like someone's had a few too many beers and
right
regret something they've done. So it's suddenly it's a swamp lady.
And then Iceland just has a giant cat that eats children.
Well,
Iceland has a giant cat that eats children, but also, you know, very often some kind of troll that lives in the mountain pass that will try to eat you as you cross over, right? Or throw a rock at you and so on. So again,
I'm wondering how much of these were created by parents trying to stop their children from misbehaving, because it reminds me of a story that my mum once told me, that my grandma used to, there's a building in Huddersfield Town Centre called, I think it's like Lion's Gate House or something, and it's got a giant stone lion that stands on top of it. And my grandma used to tell my mum when she was young that if you stay out in town after dark, this lion comes down and eats you. So basically,
yeah, like,
but that was kind of like my grandma saying to my mum, don't be in town after dark. So I wonder kind of like how many of these stories are just parents been like, look, don't stay out in the dark, or this troll over there is going to come and eat you, or a swamp lady is going to get you.
If you're ever spend like some time in a room with like more than two children, you're like, oh, okay, I see where trolls come from now.
Yeah, maybe it was a husband who was out late, and you know he had a mistress but got caught out. So it's the swamp lady made me do it. It's not my fault. It was the swamp lady.
That's what all these stories is always about in some capacity. Like any folktale, any myth is always about the human condition and the things that the very real things that we experience in different ways. Right. And yeah, we have like this vivid imagery to put to it, and narratives and meaning that we can load into any kind of context. Right. But ultimately, yeah, it is to make sure that you don't go out at night and hurt yourself, or, you know, these stories are, yeah, some jerk who's like, yeah, it's the swamp lady.
It's easy to forget that, you know, we look at these people, it's 1,000 years ago, and you kind of, not dehumanize them, you think of them as something different to us. When in reality, they are humans. They, you know, they laugh, they cry, they do all the same things we do. So it makes sense that they would make up these stories, you know, because the kid's misbehaving or something. Yeah.
There's nothing new under the sun.
No, exactly.
Absolutely or, nothing new.
You know, not men, unfortunately, you know, men lie. And guaranteed one of these stories has come from a man lying about something.
Probably, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I just wanted to bring another thing into the mix here. So you were talking about how these people probably like saw everything is like localized right around them. And we have actually an example of that. We have this story in Grimnismal that gives us a sense of what a landscape full of gods would actually look like. This is a really fascinating story because it's definitely some kind of initiation ritual. Odin has been hanging out in between two fires where he has been put by the evil King Geirrodr. And that has gone on for 9 nights, I guess. And now he's delusional. So Geirrodr, this evil king, he has a son named Agnar. And Agnar brings Odin a taste of mead. And we all know what happens when you drink mead, right? That's like a direct link to the gods. It's like the divine hotline.
Order mead from Horns of Odin.
That's you can come back on again.
So after Odin has had his mead from Horns of Odin, horn from Horns of Odin, he starts reciting cosmological poetry. He begins by saying that the land is holy, that he can see there, which is close to the gods and the elves, as he says. And then he says, the Thor lives in Thrudheimr. Ydalir belongs to Utlur. So Ydalir means something like yew tree valley or something like that. And then he tells us that Alfheim belongs to Freyr. So the world of the elves belongs to Freyr. Then he says he can see a town or some kind of built dwelling called Valaskjalfr that belongs to the giant the great god. And that's a little iffy. We don't know who he's actually talking about there. But next one is Sökkvabekkur, which means sinking bench. And that's where Sauga lives. And he tells us that he himself, Odin, goes and visits her there underneath the waves. So that's in the ocean or in a lake.
For the great god, do you think he was talking about Tyr? Like, at what point was this when he kind of took over from Tyr as like the head of the gods?
It's a good question. It could be Tyr. It could be himself. It could also be sort of like, again, a Christian element to this poem, right, because this poem is probably composed in the 11th or 12th century. We're not entirely sure, but it could be either or, so to speak. But the one thing that speaks against him talking about himself is that he then begins talking about Valhöll. But the thing is that he talks about he talks about Hroptr first. So that's another Odin name, who lives in Valhöll. And he gives us like these descriptions. This is also where we get the description of Valhöll as this place with like the shields for the roof and mail coats strewn on the benches and all that stuff. But going on from there, he talks about Thrymheimr, which is most certainly a sort of mountainous realm that used to belong to Thjazi, the eagle I was talking about before, and now belongs to Skadi, who's included as a goddess of who belongs to the gods now. Breidablik belongs to Baldur. The notion Breidablik, which means wide view, right? Could be something that has to do with plains or mountains. Himinbjörg means heaven's mountain, And that's where Heimdall has his home. And so he like goes on and like lists all of these places that these different deities live. Folkvangr, of course, Freya's house. Noatun is Njörður's home, and that means shipyard. So some a place by the ocean. And finally, the last one, he says, you know, brushwood and high grass grows in Vida's lands out in the outskirts of all of this. So it looks like he sort of like he gives us a description of what could have been sort of like the village environment, basically, in the Viking Age with all the different elements that this is over here. This is where we build our ships. This is where the peasant lives. This is where the Forseti, the judge lives, you know, all of that stuff. These are the mountains over there, some forest over there. And then, you know, we have the outskirts, which are where we have the brushwood and the high grass growing and all that stuff. So that nice little package right there in that poem that gives us a sense of how a Viking could have seen, you know, their mythological landscape around them.
It's fascinating. Like, it's insane. Like how much we don't know. Like, but then you get a poem like that that I guess gives you so much insight, and you have to try and dissect what you can from it. And I think it's insane thinking about what people have done to try and understand and put this all together. It's not something that I could have done. You know, I guess I'd be very literal and just kind of read it and go, oh, okay, so this is, it says what it says. But then, you know, with scholars like yourself, you've got to really kind of read between the lines almost and really try and dissect as much information out of every last little line and word. And do you like the fact that there's so much open space to kind of not insert your own things, but to theorize on what things meant? Or would you prefer that we just had like a book that said, this is exactly how it was, this was this, this is how they did this? And
I think if they wanted to, yeah, I think if they wanted to live like that, they would have been a more written tradition people.
Mm. Yeah, no, the last thing I would want is a book that just gives us like all the details. That sounds so boring. The thing is, being suspended between the fact that you have, right, that word that's written right there in that book, and then whatever you can interpret that with, that's your freedom right there. Right? That's where you have freedom, between those two points. So, you know, I value freedom very highly, and I think that it's great that we have something that we can, you know, be creative with. As human beings, as much as we want to, you know, we can also decide to be literal about this, like, okay, that's fine, that's what it is, or we can try to interpret. You know, as a scholar, I decided to become a professional interpreter of this material. That's really what I did. That's what people like me do, right? And become professional interpreters. That means that we get some tools that, you know, the average person doesn't have access to because they didn't take that 10-year-old education or 10-year education, right? But I mean, you know, essentially, in many ways, we're doing what anybody else is doing, what Andrew is doing when he's creating music, right? We're interpreting. And you know, when we as human beings, regardless of our background, go to this material and start interpreting, we do it. I assume that most people do it out of a genuine interest and also a genuine love for the material. And that's, I think, is the most important part about it.
Yeah, I think if you have, you know, people even in this kind of futuristic age wanting to dress up like Vikings and tell stories and still to this day make books and albums and movies, it stands to reason that they wanted to do the exact same thing back then, that these same stories captivated them and they wanted to, you know, to interpret them in different ways. And you know, everyone wants to be in Valhalla, but I don't think they really understand that they probably won't. I remember watching Wardruna here in LA, and he was talking about what happens when you die, and he was about to do that the hell song, and everyone started screaming out Valhalla. and Einar says, well, that depends.
Exactly right. No, that's exactly the thing, you know. And of course, yeah, we will choose the most preferable version,
right?
The coolest one, the one that suits our situation right now. I mean, at least if nothing else, if we're using this material to bolster ourselves as human beings, right?
Yeah, if we had a literal book, then I would lose all my lunchtime entertainment of reading Facebook groups. I think I go through a cycle of who goes into Valhalla, the Vegvisia isn't Viking.
Okay, Ragnar.
Okay, Ragnar.
I really want to make a shirt like that. I got to ask Caddy's permission, but I really want to have like a shirt design where, you know, kind of drawn in a stone kind of way, having like a Freyr or yeah, Freya would, just yeah, kind of putting his hand through Ragnar saying, okay.
What I would wish, though, what I would hope for in general is that people would be a little more forgiving when it comes to people's interpretations. You know, you mentioned these Facebook groups. And yeah, people make mistakes and they make the same mistakes over and over. And by the gods, I have been annoyed by this so many times myself in my life. But ultimately, I think we should also employ a little empathy when people do these things and do make these interpretations. Because everybody's coming from their own outset, right? Like that you have your platform, and that platform can be more or less informed, right? And so I feel like, you know, if anybody's listening out there and they hang out on those groups and they really feel the need to jump on this noob who who comes in and says the same stupid thing that a million other people have said, just give them a break, man.
Let the Vikings have their mohawk hair.
Yeah. Let the Vikings have their mohawk hair if you want. Like it doesn't matter.
Let's say it's. I guess some people think that they're instantly better, and rather than trying to educate, they just kind of like, well, it's not that, it's this, and kind of shout it, and it just seems kind of pointless in my mind. I think what's wrong with just trying to help somebody? And I think people respond more to, you know, it's like, well, this is what we actually know, or point them in the direction of a really good Norse mythology podcast. And I think people would, you know, respond better to that rather than just being demeaned and belittled and shouted at.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, we do the same thing with today's stories, you know, talking about how Thor and Iron Man can't be this gender or, you know, such and such. It nothing really changes, and so I think in all things empathy is most important.
I agree. Yeah, and you know, like the thing is that everybody who is involved with this material, from, you know, those story writers at Marvel to somebody who really likes to, you know, get drunk in a Floki outfit at a Wardruna concert, or goes to Viking markets or heavy metal shows, Viking themed, or whatever they're doing, right? Everybody's actually got the same perspective, the same objective in all of this, and that is, you know, to keep the culture alive. That's really it. That's what everybody's doing in their own way, trying to do. So ultimately, everybody's you know, aligned in that sense, regardless of where they otherwise come from in that regard.
Yeah, we find ourselves in these stories, or we find aspects that we wish or aspire to, you know, to become. And I think that's something that should, you know, always be celebrated.
Absolutely. We're gonna have to wrap this one up. So, Andrew, let people know where they can listen to the EP, where they can get it. Obviously, it came out last Friday.
Yeah, it came out on the 14th. Yeah, it's out now. You can get it on Apple Music, iTunes, Deezer, Amazon, Spotify, and for the, like, maybe the five people on Tidal. You could find it on there. And so if you go to theseawolfmusic.com, there's links to everything on there.
Yeah, so people are typing in Seawolf. That's your performing.
Yeah, so the Seawolf.
Okay.
So
I just didn't want anybody typing in your real name and not being able to find you.
Yeah.
So what song are you on, Matthias? Which one do people need to listen closely to?
Well, it's the Urdabrunner, right?
Yes.
That is what it's called, the Urdus well. Now Urdur was, of course, a figure that we didn't get to talk much about, but there's plenty to unpack with her and the other Norns as well.
I'm sure we will get to it in one of the episodes. I mean, Andrew, you're more than welcome back when, you know, next time you're releasing something, when you release the first album, feel free to come back on.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to.
It's been fun. What about social media? Where can people find you?
So same kind of thing. The Seawolf on Facebook and Twitter. And then on Instagram, it's lo.vi.music. Kind of created that genre, low Viking music, just because nothing else was kind of like the sound that I could really point to.
I'll share your Instagram when I post on the Horns of Odin Instagram anyway, so people can just click on that and follow you straight away and find you nice and easy. Obviously, people can find Matthias over at Matthias Nordvig. You can get a hold of me at Horns of Odin, or I started using my own personal Instagram now, so that's at @D_Farrand1, because someone already had the @D_Farrand.
Oh no.
And I feel like I would rather be like @D_Farrand112 rather than the one. It's like,
you should change it to the official.
The official.
Try to get a blue tick.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna have to change it to like public figure.
Yeah.
So anything you want to say, Matthias, before we wrap up?
Well, I want to thank everybody for once again listening to my rants, and I want to thank you, Andrew, for joining us here. It's really a pleasure talking about this.
Thank you very much. And quickly, if you enjoy the podcast, please take a moment to leave us a 5-star review and a positive rating. It helps other people find us. It helps us get on the charts a little bit higher. So thank you very much. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.